to set up this this dictionary, we still need a basic ingredient. If I start with a reductive group G, now we're going to kind of pull a little sleight of hand. Before, our reductive group G was a complex reductive group. Now I'll really need kind of an arithmetic version. I'll need a group over my field F. But again, let me just think I have, you know, your favorite GLN, SLN, or whatever, like a split reductive group. And then we need an object that plays the role of bun G for our three manifold. And there is such an object in the arithmetic theory. People don't usually call it bun G. People sometimes use a subnotation like G bracket F. So this is going to be some version of the space of G bundles associated to a three manifold. It's really associated. In practice, you never have things that are everywhere unramified. So we need to fix level structure. So we're always really talking about ramified versions of bun G in the arithmetic situation. You have to fix level structure along some primes, or if you like, along some link in your three manifold. So there's a version of where you look at some congruence condition at a finite set of primes. So what is this object bun G? It's not an algebraic stack. In the finite field setting, it's, if you like, just a set. In the finite field setting, it is really just bun G. We get the set, look at bun G of my curve, and I look at its set of FQ points, or if you like, a group point of FQ points. Over number fields, the thing that plays the role of bun G are these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. Given a group and a field and some level structure, we have an associated arithmetic locally symmetric space, maybe denoted something poetically as some real group divided by some compact group divided by some arithmetic group. And again, the thing we have in mind is the upper half plane, which is PSL2R mod SO2 mod, say, PSL2Z. So this is the analog of upper half plane mod PSL2Z. You can define for any reductive group. It's no longer a complex manifold or have any link to algebraic geometry. So you shouldn't think about this as something like modular elliptic curve, just as a arithmetic locally symmetric space. And it has this kind of more uniform description in the language of Adels, which I don't really want to get into, but there's this kind of Adelic double quotient, which Andre Vey explained is exactly what gives you the set of points of bun G. So you could think about this Adelic double quotient as really describing a G bundle in terms of local clutching data. Or maybe inside of here, I have some congruent subgroup. So in any case, there are these collection of spaces I can assign to a group over a field. And these spaces play the role of my bun G. So now I can talk about the A theory. What the A theory attaches on my three manifold, I'm going to study some spaces, some linearization of this bun G. So I'm attached a vector space. And it's going to be a complex vector space. You could do some version of L2, or maybe a better model for the topological field theory would be take the cohomology of these arithmetic locally symmetric spaces. So this is the cohomology of arithmetic groups. So that's playing the role of the AG theory on this three manifold. On the B side, there's a more, if you like, more obvious in some sense, but much more subtle in some senses, analog of Loci-Cech, which is just, so instead of the character variety or character stack of pi one of the Riemann surface gets replaced by some space of Galois representations into the complex dual group. So the dual group remains over the complex numbers. That C has to do with the fact that we're looking at C coefficients on the automorphic side. But we've taken the Galois group of my field F, and I look at representations into this complex dual group with some ramification conditions. Okay, this is a little bit of a caricature, but that's somehow the spirit. And then the B side is going to study algebraic functions, or maybe algebraic distributions, functions on this space of on this character variety. And what the Langlands program says in this kind of caricature is roughly that this A side we attach to this field, this three manifold, should be isomorphic to the B side attached to this three manifold as modules for Hecke algebras. So these are our algebras of line op, coming the analog of line operators. Okay. So this is kind of the caricature of the Langlands program in this arithmetic version. So again, this is where my space of automorphic forms are going to live. Automorphic forms should match with functions, or maybe better, distributions, functionals on functions of Galois representations. And I want to think about this as a case of this S-duality evaluated on my three manifold. And there are similar versions for these two manifolds associated to local fields. And that is going to give the local Langlands correspondence. But rather than, so that's a whole topic to spell out, let me just try to spell out what I'd like to get to is spelling out how do periods look in this, and why do periods look like boundary conditions? That's somehow my goal here, is to explain that the theory of periods of automorphic forms and L functions with all our representations match with the kind of picture of boundary conditions for the A theory and B theory that we were discussing before. So, okay, but maybe I should still pause. Does this caricature make some kind of poetic sense, or?
I have one potentially extremely dumb question.
Great.
So, maybe I answered my own very dumb question. But sorry, was your F a local field or a global field?
Your F was a global field. So this is the global Langlands correspondence. So the global Langlands correspondence is about vector spaces. Vector spaces being things like automorphic vector space of automorphic forms or functions of Galois representations. So I think, so that should match with three manifolds. That's what my 4D theory attaches to three manifolds. The local Langlands correspondence is about categories of representation. So maybe I could just say that, you know, local Langlands, in local Langlands, if I have, I shouldn't call it F, but let's say K is a local field. I guess K is also taken, but so for example, K could be QP. I could look at the category of representations of say G of QP. So I look at a category of some say smooth representations of this group. So that's my category. And I want to think of that category as roughly what the A theory attaches to K, to this thought of as a two manifold. Really, it's a full subcategory. There's something bigger here, but that's the picture. And the local Langlands correspondence matches these with some category, which is some category of coherent sheaves on the stack of local Langlands parameters. Langlands, so representations parameters, so representations over of the Galois group of K bar over K. And that's my B side. So global Langlands is about vector spaces, local Langlands is about categories.
And that's okay.
Great. So where do periods fit into all of this? What was the idea of a period? Well, my period was I'm going to take an automorphic form and integrate it over something. So what the example we had was this n period and t period, these integrals of particular cycles in the upper half space. That has a natural generalization. Given a subgroup of G of my arithmetic group, I can look at the kind of inclusion of bun H into bun G. Map bun H to bun G. And those are going to be the kind of cycles that I was talking about before. So I can define the H period of an automorphic form as going to be just restrict that, integrated over this bun H. That or version with a character matches the measurements we talked about for modular forms before. Now it turns out it's better not to think about a subgroup. So these first periods we discussed came from subgroups. It's better not to think about a subgroup, but I'm going to replace H by a G space X, which in the example a group would, so I can replace H by the homogeneous space G mod H, and then I can replace that by a more general G space that's not necessarily homogeneous, and talk about X periods. So rather than H periods, I could talk about X periods. So in this set of X periods, I don't have as obvious, I don't have an obvious analog of bun H inside of bun G. What you naturally have is some kind of correspondence. So you have the space bun G, which was given as some kind of adelic double quotient. Let me write something terribly messy, and then I'll try to tell you it's something you already know in a concrete situation. So the kind of messy thing is could do is I could take the adelic points of X mod out by my integral adels or whatever congruent subgroup I'm looking at. So if you like, this is the product, so some kind of product of X over local fields mod G of their ring of integers. So here I'm looking at, this is some version of the loop space of X. It's X over a local field, and this is G of the ring of integers of the local field. And these two spaces are not related by a map, but they're related by a correspondence. So there's a natural correspondence between these. So you can write something. So I'll write some, again, this is kind of a mess, but I could look at G of A mod X of F, or some natural correspondence you could write between these two spaces. And this correspondence defines, rather than defining, it defines integral transforms. So we can take functions or cohomology classes on bun G and pull them back and push forward to here and pair with functions or cohomology classes on this space. So the way this is usually, I wish I had a scrolling page. Doesn't scroll, so I'll have to just move this up. So the way this in the number theory, this gets becomes what's called the theta series operator. So the theta series operator is an intertwiner from L2 functions or cohomology, so again, linearization of this left-hand side of this. Of this product of these X of F, X of K mod G of O's, to my L2 of my bun G, which is my space of automorphic forms. And this is an intertwiner for natural symmetries for the Hecke operators. And so what is the period of an automorphic form? The idea is the period of automorphic form is I can take an automorphic form that's an element of this linearization. So the period is I'm going to pair phi with some basic test function on the left-hand side. So by pair, I'm going to say, by adjunction, I can either take phi and transfer it over to this local space coming from X's and then integrate there, or I can move the function from local spaces to the global space and integrate there. So there's a natural pairing between functions on bun G and functions on these local spaces given by this correspondence. And the basic function, so you say, what is this mess going to look like? Well, inside of X of K mod G of O, I have X of O mod G of O, the ring of integers of my local field. And I can take the basic function I want to take is I just take the characteristic function of X of O mod G of O. That's going to be the function I want to take at all places if I can. This doesn't make sense at Archimedean places, so there it gets replaced by some kind of Gaussian. But there's some basic test functions we're going to take and match with my automorphic form, and that's what defines a period. I know this probably makes no sense at the moment. I'm going to say all this in a second geometrically, and it'll hopefully resonate better. But I just wanted to relate this because this is what. This is the way integral representations of L functions work in the literature. This goes back, if you'd like to Riemann, when Riemann wrote the Riemann zeta function, up to some gamma function and some power of pi, could be written as this Mellin transform. This Mellin transform, some sum of this pairing, this integral pairing, this is some kind of theta series. We're going to take here, we're taking the constant function one and pairing it with a theta series. And this realization in the work of Iwasawa and Tate's thesis, this becomes exactly described in the way before, is that abelian L functions. So L functions like Dedekind zeta functions, Dirichlet L functions, all that kind of L functions associated to Galois representations are periods in this sense. They're integrate against the theta series of a test function. In the special case where the group G is the multiplicative group, so that's the group we're doing abelian harmonic analysis, and we're thinking about this, and here's just the crucial point I want to say, is that when you're studying the Riemann zeta function, you're studying the harmonic analysis of the multiplicative group acting on the additive group. So where did this additive group come from? That's my X. So I have this X, which is in this case just A1. So we look at that natural action of the multiplicative group on the additive group, and you can do harmonic analysis. You can take functions on the additive group and do their kind of Mellin transform, decompose them under the multiplicative group. And that's where the Riemann zeta function comes from. And I want to think about this as a period. Here again, that's why it's important not to restrict to homogeneous spaces. This is a torque variety, if you like. It's not a homogeneous space. So even in the very, very first example, you don't want to take a period associated to a subgroup. You want a period associated to a G space. So that's the idea, is that this theory, classical theory of integral representation of L functions, even in the abelian case, is naturally given in terms of periods for some G spaces. Sorry, Davide, question. I think you're muted.
And I think geometric Langdon's statements are also about a true normalizable functions on Bann. And one way to produce a true normalizable function on Bann is to take a beta gamma system or something like that, which has a G action, and take the partition function on the Riemann surface. This could give you things like 1/theta function. Is it close? Is this, should I think about this as closely related to that?
Yes. Yeah. I think that's the same kind of. I won't be able to make a precise statement on the spot, but I think that's the same flavor. So we're going to be thinking of coupling, you know, simple field theories with the G action and looking at the kind of partition function of that boundary condition. So that's a kind of construction we get that gives us functions or sheaves on spaces of G bundles, depending on how we set it up. And the idea is that that's exactly what these theta series or periods are doing. So this is the so here there's some weird, the thing that looks maybe unfamiliar here is there's this Gaussian appearing. You say, where did the Gaussian come from? The Gaussian again come from this because we had a three manifold with boundary. We had to decide what to do at the Archimedean places, and there isn't an analog of this X of O mod G of O. But let me work in the function field setting. Let me repeat everything I said in the function field setting, where this just becomes something very nice and geometric. And I'm going to do the unramified version, the everywhere unramified, which I can make sense of in the function field setting. So in the function field setting, I can look at Bun G, and over Bun G, I have the space which is, let me call Bun GX, and it matches notation to what I had before. These are G bundles plus a section of the associated X bundle. Okay, so I can look at the space of, as a G space X, I can look at G bundles with a section of the associated X bundle. And then I can, if I'm working over a finite field, I'm looking at level of functions, I get a functional, this period functional associated to X, which is, if you'd like to push forward some kind of compactly supported push forward of kind of the constant function on Bun GX. And this is a function on the space of Bun G, and that's the X period function. And so if you like pairing with this period function, that's what I'm calling the period of an automorphic form. Function on Bun G, I can pair with by X. So just to make this concrete, the Tate period the abelian case, you know, again, that's G equals GM acting on X equals A1. And then what we have here, bun G is just the Picard group, the space of line bundles. And then bun GX is just the line bundles with a section of the associated line bundle. I don't know. It's line bundles together with a holomorphic section, which is just, if you like, the union of symmetric powers of the curve. So I look at the union of symmetric powers of the curve, being a little sloppy about the stackiness. And I'm just thinking about the map from the union of symmetric powers to pick. I'm taking the constant function one and pushing it forward. That gives me a basic function on pick, and that's this Tate period. And the Tate Iwasawa story of L functions is the L function of a function on pick is just integrated against this push forward function. If you like, pull back from pick to the symmetric powers and integrate. Okay, so that's how this is the unramified. This is the version where I put inside of here, I have X of K. Here my K is FQ, my local field is FQ Lorentz series T. Inside of it, I have O, which is FQ formal power series of T. And I look at X of K mod G of O. This is the loop space of X, algebraic loop space, maps from Lorentz series. I'm looking at mod arcs in G. And inside of here, I have X of O mod G of O. So that's arcs in X mod arcs in G. I take the constant function on there and I use that as my test function. And that gives, at every place, that gives me this this Tate period. Okay. So I can make more ramified versions. That's at various places, I can introduce other functions on here instead of just this basic function. But this is the basic setup. So if you'd like, you maybe just to skip ahead, there's an obvious geometric version of this where I replace, well, I guess what I'm calling everything geometric maybe, but here I'm working over an algebraically closed field, which can be complex numbers or, so it could be e.g. the complex numbers or FQ bar. And I can do the same picture, but now I look at the moduli stack of G bundles with a section of the associated X bundle. And I have this map to bun G, let's call this map pi. And I can define the period sheaf, the X period sheaf. Now I'm using calligraphic. I take the push forward of the constant sheaf on bun GX. And that's an object of my category of sheaves on bun G, which is my A side on sigma. Sigma is a curve over this field. And that's what we would like to, that's what we call period sheaf. So this is the X period sheaf. This object is exactly quantizes the Gyodo-Lagrangian we talked about before for M, which is the Hamiltonian G space given by the cotangent bundle of X. So if you talk about, if your Hamiltonian G space is polarized, is the cotangent bundle, I gave you a construction before of a Lagrangian on cotangent bundle of bun G, and that Lagrangian can be quantized easily in the polarized case to give a sheaf, which is this X period sheaf. So now I think hopefully you're starting to see that parallel, how this period functional matches exactly with the kind of data we had before from a boundary condition, these Lagrangian, that this BAA brain associated to Lagrangian. Okay, it's important that to emphasize here that we, if you like, we started with a subgroup H of G, and then we replace it by a homogeneous space, but then more generally just a G space that needn't be homogeneous. And then we can take that space and replace it by its cotangent bundle. And now that's a Hamiltonian G space. And the real kind of the proper home we claim for the theory of periods is not this and not this, but this, just like in the theory of boundary conditions. You really don't want to think about a subgroup as indexes a period. You don't want to think about the G space as what indexes a period, but you want to think about a Hamiltonian G space. In other words, what you want to do is take a Hamiltonian G space and quantize it to a boundary condition. And that's kind of the data that indexes a period. And that gives a lot more examples that covers a lot more classic. It gives more symmetry, and it also gives more examples. In fact, this goes back all the way to Tait's thesis in some sense. Tait's thesis, the functional equation, for the zeta function, for the Riemann zeta function, comes from doing a Fourier transform on A1. So really, what does that mean? We're thinking about A1, we're really working on the quantization of T star A1. We're working on A1 microlocally. The Fourier transform is not a symmetry of A1, it kind of comes from a symmetry of T star A1. And so we have these two different, if you like, two different G spaces, A1 and the dual A1, but they're both give polarizations of the same Hamiltonian G space. And the functional equation is just that realization. So that's one motivation why you really want to think about periods as being indexed by Hamiltonian spaces after some quantization procedure. So, okay. So let's see. There are two things I need to tell you. One is strictly more interesting than the other, but I probably need to do both. One thing I want to tell you is what class of spaces we're going to be restricting to, just to, and the second is I want to now make the dictionary between the boundary conditions and the periods and the L functions more precise. So let me just be a little brief about what class of spaces we're going to be looking at. So we need to impose some very strong finiteness conditions. This is the kind of conditions you might imagine from extended topological field theory. You are going to have our boundary condition is going to have some very strong finiteness for the measurements we want to make sense. So for example, when I keep writing about these integrals, there's all kinds of convergence issues. If I just take some arbitrary G space X, there's going to be no way of making sense of these integrals, which is the whole point of the business. So we have to make some very strong finiteness conditions. And sort of experimentally, I think it was found that there's a class of spaces for which the periods are well-behaved, or if you like, that where our partition functions on some four manifolds will make sense, comes from looking at X to be not an arbitrary G space, but to be a spherical variety. So let me say a few words about spherical varieties. So this is, spherical varieties are exactly the non-abelian version of toric varieties. So when G is a multiplicative group, when G is a torus, this spherical variety just means toric variety. So that's a condition. And now what is toric variety? It means I have this open orbit of the group. So that means I have a big action. So the space X is very small compared to the group. The action is big. So how do you say that bigness? I guess the definition is that X is spherical means that if I look inside of G, I look not at all of G, just at the Borel subgroup. In the case of a torus, this is everything. In general, I just look at the Borel subgroup. I need this to have an open orbit on X. So that's saying that X is small, even B almost fills up X. Maybe a more conceptual definition in the affine case is, over an algebraically closed field, is that I want functions on X to be a small representation of G. Algebraic functions on X should be a multiplicity one representation. In other words, every irreducible appears at most once. That's a condition on the functions on X. It should have every irreducible representation of G that appears can only appear once. A more geometric condition that's probably much more relevant is when I look at the loop space of X, and I look at the action of arcs in G, of the positive subgroup of G, I want this to be discrete orbits, discrete set of orbits. So I don't want a continuous orbit. That means that the action of LG plus is, so there's a poset of orbits on LX rather than something more complicated. So this is the kind of situation we see in things like geometric satake. And indeed, the one example of a spherical variety is the group itself is a spherical variety for the action, not of itself, but of G cross G on the left, on the right. So that's the discreteness in the Satake correspondence. That's also, if you like, the Peter Weil theorem, that every irreducible representation of G cross G appears at most once in functions on G. Okay, so that's an important example. That's kind of the group case. So there are many interesting examples of spherical varieties. They cover a lot of the spaces that we care about in representation theory. As I said, there's toric varieties, flag varieties also appear, or things like, for example, we could think of G mod N as a G cross T space. That's the thing that appeared in the Eisenstein example. That's an example of a spherical variety. Symmetric spaces, spaces are natural examples of spherical variety. As I said, the group case, G cross G acting on G, that's another spherical variety. Then there's this awesome class of examples coming from multiplicity one. There's a bunch of multiplicity one restriction problems in classical groups, where I look at representations of GLN and they restrict with multiplicity one to GLN minus one. And so that corresponds to the statement that if I look at GLN as a not just GLN cross GLN space, but GLN times GLN minus one space, even the smaller group, this is still spherical. So that's expressing this multiplicity one, and there's famous examples for orthogonal groups. The restriction problem for orthogonal groups also has multiplicity one. There's a unitary version. In number theory, this goes by the name of the Gangros-Passad program in studying this family of spherical varieties and associated periods. There's a lot more examples. For example, in the Hecke period that appeared in the very beginning, this PGL2 mod torus is an example of a spherical variety that doesn't fit in. That's kind of a little bit of a exotic one. This T period of a modular form, that's why it was weird there. It didn't come, if I look at, you could say a higher rank group mod T, that's a perfectly fine space, but it's not a spherical variety. So I can't just say G mod T. That doesn't give me an example. In the Hecke case, it does. And that's where the Hecke period of the modular form comes from. So
these all look like boundary conditions which on the dual side have no gauge fields, no three-dimensional gauge fields. Perhaps have no Coulomb branch. Sorry, no Higgs branch. I guess that's a...
No, I'm not sure. I mean, these spaces, these class of spaces I'm going to give you, it's going to be a self-dual class. So it's not. Whatever words you say on the other side should be applied on the A side. For example, this class, as we were saying before, was self-dual, the Eisenstein class. Flag varieties are roughly self-dual class. The group case is self-dual. The group case.
They neither Higgs branch nor Coulomb branch.
They will have a Coulomb branch, so I don't know. So that can't be right. Because the Coulomb branch construction is how we're going to get the duality.
No, it's fine, but. After you couple them to the 4D gauge theory, perhaps they have no vacua.
Okay, Are you
worried about some kind of Z2 anomaly here, or is this the question?
No, I'm just trying to understand sort of what is the spherical condition implying. I feel I'm a little bit fuzzy on that.
What was the spherical condition?
I don't know. They includes a lot of interesting examples,
it includes a lot of examples that were not, I think, non-dualities before. So I definitely would love to understand.
The
ones you got here correspond to things that we know in Gestirn, but I think there are examples that don't, right? More exotic ones.
Yeah.
I think the spherical conditions should somehow impact what you mean by the dual. So somehow spherical means that the dual is some kind of so to say finite object, and for non-spherical case the dual should be some kind of very big object.
That sounds right. let me move on and don't have a good answer to this. So let me just add an adjective. I want the kind of micro-local version of this, or Hamiltonian version. We replace our X's by our M's. So now M's, this kind of spaces we're going to look at, are Hamiltonian algebraic varieties, Hamiltonian G spaces. Again, with a grading, with a compatible GM action. And the analog of the spherical condition becomes, again, a multiplicity one condition or a quasitropic condition. Quasitropic or multiplicity one, quasitropic means that a generic G orbit will be a quasitropic subset. So again, this is very small compared to the group or the multiplicity one. If I look at algebraic functions on this space and I look at invariant functions, then the ring of invariant functions should be Poisson commutative. So that's a condition that says that the group action is very big compared to the symplectic variety. And together we lump these together into a class that we call hyperspherical varieties. And so these hyperspherical varieties, I like the name as a suggestive. It would be great if they admitted complete hyperkeller metrics. Some do, I don't know any general statements, but they're somehow the non-abelian analog of hypertoric varieties. And so, for example, hypertoric varieties sit here, but these class of examples, it's useful to expand because it gives us a bunch of examples, such as the Whitaker case, the non-pole case. So the Whitaker case, if I look at the cotangent bundle of G and I do this Hamiltonian reduction with a non-trivial character, that didn't fit in the case of, it's not given just by a single spherical variety, it's a twisted version. And you could do a bunch of twisted analogs of cotangent bundles, and that gives you these. For number theory, there's something important called the theta correspondence, which is I can look at symplectic representations of groups that are not polarized. So for example, I could look at this standard tensor standard for SO2N tensor cross SP2N. There's a bunch of examples of symplectic representation. Of course, this is something well known in the physics literature and the Coulomb branch literature that I might be interested in matter that's not polarized.
David, is it important that those two ends are the same?
I think there's theta correspondences for different groups, but this is an example. I'm just
do think about that example, but I don't think they could kind of take completely arbitrary rank orthogonal and symplectic groups.
Yeah, you have a lot of these help pairs. I just need in general to make sure it's something spherical. I have to make sure the spherical condition is satisfied, right? They still have to be small. Mm-hmm. There's some intersection with the examples that appear in the physics and not quite a strict conclusion.
I think it's spherical always. It's just a question of whether, when I describe the dual, whether you can write it as a quotient bundle to something. Okay. And then I can write it as a period. But I think that this thing is spherical, or rather, in your terminology, hyperspherical always. Okay. Just by fundamental representations.
Okay, thanks. So let me just, the reason I want to, so one of the advantages of picking out this class, we prove a theorem for these hyperspherical varieties that lets you describe them, that they're obtained in a kind of relatively simple, they have a simple description. So if M, I'm going to make these pretty strong assumptions. M is going to be smooth and affine and hyperspherical with this kind of multiplicity one condition, and we just drop, this is what I mean, will mean by hyperspherical. And there's a technical condition. There's a, I need to have a generic orbit stabilizer to be connected. And there's a condition on the moment map, moment map hitting the Milbourne cone. But so there's a couple of technical conditions, but satisfied in all these examples. The claim is that for one of these varieties, then M has a very nice form. M is obtained by let me add some adjectives, like a twisted Hamiltonian induction from something simple, from a symplectic representation of a subgroup. So I have a subgroup of G, and I can write M as the cotangent bundle of G. So I'm going to make a Hamiltonian G space out of a symplectic representation. So here I have a representation of H, which is symplectic. That's an example of a Hamiltonian H space. And I can induce that to get a Hamiltonian G space. So I pair these over the moment map. I quotient out by a diagonal action of H. And then there's a, there's a Whitaker twisted version where you add a character. Maybe let's not focus on the Whitaker twisted version, but the claim is that up to passing to some twisted version of a cotangent bundle instead of a cotangent bundle, so it's like there's three pieces of data that describe these hyperspherical varieties. There's a symplectic representation, there's a subgroup, and there's kind of a Whitaker twisting data. So that means that you can reduce the study of these hyperspherical varieties. A lot of the questions reduce it to the vector case, to the case of a symplectic representation. So here the data is, I need to give a homomorphism from H cross SL2, so into G, and this SL2 is what determines this Whitaker, the twisting.
Okay. You have a classification of which S appear?
No. No.
Can I ask, what's the kind of condition on affineness doing here? Like, if I just think about toric varieties, I can get any toric variety as a cotangent bundle to a toric variety as Hamiltonian reduction of whatever, but I didn't need to know the toric variety was affine.
It's just how we construct this. I mean, we need access to the space through functions.
But ultimately, you might be able to remove that restriction.
Yeah, I mean, both the smoothness and the affineness are things you hope to escape from eventually. So, I mean, again, the theory of boundary conditions shouldn't have either smoothness or affineness. I think the spherical condition in some form seems to be important. It's a little mysterious in that where exactly there's some kind of strong finiteness you're going to need. Spherical might be too strong from what you actually want, but there's going to be some strong finiteness that makes things work, some kind of finite multiplicity condition. This is where we can prove things. This is where we can match things with things, calculations in the literature. And so maybe one thing to say is that this class we put a bunch of adjectives, and what we conjecture is that with this bunch of adjectives, this class of boundary conditions is self-dual. So maybe I try to formulate that, but that certainly will not be true. If you remove affineness or smoothness or so on, the duals will look different. So this is a very strong condition, and one of our main conjectures is that this class of boundary conditions is self-dual. So I haven't said what the dual is. Let me just say that there's a big literature, and let me just mention a couple of the key names. But there's papers of Sikelaridis and the book of Sikelaridis and Venkatesh, and a paper of Sikelaridis and Wang, and other papers of Friedrich Knopp really started a lot of the theory. But the idea is that given, let me just say in the spherical, rather hyperspherical case, given a spherical variety, you can attach a succession of bigger and bigger, more and more collection of Langlands dual data. So Knopp first attached a Cartan, a vial group acting on a kind of Cartan, a dual Cartan, a torus for X, that reduces to the little vial group acting on the Cartan for a symmetric space. And then Gaetz-Gori Nadler expanded this to define a subgroup of the Langlands dual group. You get a subgroup of the Langlands dual group associated to a spherical variety that they defined in a kind of satake flavored way. The works of Sekelaridis and Sekelaridis Wang let you also attach a representation of this Langlands dual subgroup, or really you build it out of weights out of this combinatorics of spherical variety. And they built this collection of dual data out of studying harmonic analysis on spherical varieties. And in one of our kind of proposals is that rather than you should collect all these data into what we might call the spectral period or the dual period, which is you build a space M check exactly out of these data. You build a Hamiltonian variety for, I should say there also, in fact, there's maybe a little more data just to match this. There's actually a homomorphism. There's an SL2. Sekularides and Venkatesh defined also an SL2 subgroup commuting with this. So from this data, you can define exactly the kind of space that appeared on the previous slide, where this is going to be my subgroup H check. So H check, U check. Anyway, my notation is terrible and probably doesn't matter. But let me just say, you can define a space of the same formula. And our proposal is that we should be thinking not about this collection of data, but about this Hamiltonian, that this is a Hamiltonian G-dual space. G-dual space, and that it's the dual to M-check, to original M in the sense of the Gayota-Witten duality. So let me try to say that more precisely. Given a hyperspherical variety, you can build this dual space. The conjecture is that this defines a duality on the class of hyperspherical variety, where hyperspherical includes all these adjectives, affine and smooth. So given a hyperspherical variety, you can build a new one, this dual. And the conjecture is, in particular, that the double dual is the original space. I'm really running out of time, aren't I? How much time do I have? Maybe I can. Ben or someone say. Do we have a time estimate?
I mean, roughly zero.
Roughly zero. Okay. All right. So, So I missed the most interesting part, but let me just finish with the kind of meta conjecture. And this is the kind of the point about the whole story is that, that if M and M check are dual hyperspherical varieties, so they're defined by this kind of combinatorial procedure as that I kind of outlined before. The conjecture says that M defines a boundary condition. Let me call P sub M is a boundary condition for the A theory. So this is my notation for a boundary condition in the automorphic TFT. M check will define a boundary condition. Let me call the L condition for M check, a boundary condition for the spectral TFT. And that under the S duality, these boundary conditions match. So I have an equivalence between this construction gives you matching boundary conditions. And so what is this conjecture saying? This conjecture includes a collection of statements when we evaluate this field theory on lots and lots of different spaces. So maybe just to give a kind of schematic, you can evaluate your theory you can do a kind of local and global, and you can do a arithmetic and geometric. You have a kind of at least a 2x2 grid just in the function field setting of conjectures. So here, global geometric, this is when I'm studying, this is usual geometric Langlands. This I'm studying on the A side, I'm studying sheaves on Von G and QC Shriek of Loke. So this is the usual geometric Langlands, and there's this conjecture implies a matching of objects. You define this BAA brain, it should match with this BBB brain. So that's the kind of Gayota-Witten style conjecture. There's a local geometric conjecture. That's an equivalence of categories. It's sheaves on loop space of X mod LG plus should match with sheaves on this M check. Sorry. So there's a, this is the statement that you get in the local geometric Langlands setting. And then you have statements in the local arithmetic, global arithmetic. The global arithmetic is the statement about matching of the period associated to M should equal the L function built out of this M check, which I didn't describe. There's a local arithmetic situation, which is about the harmonic analysis on X of F should match with roughly have to do with algebraic functions on F check, Frobenius fixed points. Anyway, there's a collection of a grid of conjectures and compatibilities between them. So for example, in the compatibilities, the arrows go, there's some kind of Euler product relation between local and global in arithmetic and a factorization homology, like compatibility between local and global in geometry. And there's going from geometry to arithmetic is given by taking traces of Frobenius. So there's a collection of conjectures and kind of compatibilities between them. And so that's somehow the idea that the knowing about this Gyota-Witten duality for boundary conditions lets you understand how to package a whole bunch of invariants in the number theory. I didn't get time to explain like where this theta series operator naturally appears out of the field theory, kind of all of the structure that appears in the study of harmonic analysis on spherical varieties naturally is things you see out of TFT. And the TFT framework allows you to organize these into statements where you have not just a kind of a coincidence and some L functions are given by periods, but a science, like I was proposing, that if you have an L function, you attach it to a spherical variety, then you can calculate which period integral representation it should have, the one given by the dual spherical variety. Okay, so I should stop there. Thanks.
Are there any questions? I mean, I have many. One I was wondering about is part of this definition of being hyperspherical having a C star action that's weight two on the symplectic form?
Yes. Yeah. I want to be for me a hyperspherical is a graded Hamiltonian, G space. Yeah. So I otherwise, you know, you only get kind of a Z2 version of this, in other words, Anskiwitten theory. So I need some extra R symmetry. So that's the class we're going to, and that appears in the number theory in various natural settings. So the grading is something very, very natural in the arithmetic setting as well.
I have a question about local theories. This is something that I was confused already for some time. So suppose that you want to do it not on the level of equivalence of categories, but on the level of saying that two category, I mean, let's consider not the category of LG plus equivalent sheaves, but the category of all sheaves on the LX, and just view it as a category of with an LG action. And then suppose that you want to compute its Langlands dual, then it should be a category which leaves over local systems on the formal punctured disk. And I'm confused about how to say what that is in terms of M-check. Do you know how to say this? I mean, it should have the property that if you take its fiber of a trivial local system, then you recover this quasi-coe of M-check or something like this.
Yeah,
but I wasn't able to cook that up.
Yeah, I think you can write that. I mean, that is some causal duality in where the. I mean, you know, you can write that. You know, that's all these statements. Okay, maybe I should say a few things. I mean, all these statements are much easier to do in the polarized case, right? If you happen to be a cotangent bundle, or we treat equally, so to speak, the Whitaker case, the twisted cotangent bundles. If you're not polarized, then as in your recent paper, you know, you need more science.
Yeah, the question is, suppose that M-check is actually a representation, then can you, but it's,
the M-check is a representation is difficult in general, right? So it's gonna be difficult for this question, but it's difficult for much easier questions too. So let's just treat the case where M-check is polarized. It's a twisted cotangent.
Yeah, when it's polarized, I know what the answer is. The answer is that they should take, you know, half of it, so the Lagrangian, and then should take the local systems for the flat sections with value in that hub.
But the
question is it possible to say it when it's not polarized?
I mean, that's a hard question, and that's a hard question for, as I was saying, for easier questions than the local, than the fully ramified conjecture. I mean, even to formulate this for the unramified conjecture, you have to be careful what exactly you.
Actually, even if it is polarized, then it would be, then it's not obvious to me. It doesn't depend on the choice of polarization.
Right. Right. So that's something you can prove in some cases, but that's not trivial. Yeah. So no, I mean, this is part of the, part of the story. What to say? Like, the Hamiltonians, the boundary condition is not actually a Hamiltonian space. It's a quantization of a Hamiltonian space, right? That to give a Hamiltonian space is not enough to give the boundary condition. You have to quantize that. And on the automorphic side, this has to do with the kind of metaplectic representation type issues. On the spectral side, that you need to do again some kind of B-side, like to describe Rozanski-Witten theory. I mean, you can ask much easier questions, right? Just what is Rozanski-Witten theory for a non-polarized space do? What is the vector space you attach to a Riemann surface in Rozanski-Witten theory for a symplectic representation? And that, you can give an answer to that, but that answer is, there's some anomalies there, and the answer is not, it's not, for this, so to say, a functor of the symplectic vector space. So even in that, that's a much easier question than what you're asking. But even there, I don't know of a very clean answer to that question. So you're asking, what's the analog of that, in not for Rozanski-Witten theory on a Riemann surface, but for Rozanski-Witten theory on the circle?
But I'm saying, even on the Riemann surface. I thought that would be simpler.
It's not. I mean, even if I ask what is Rozanski-Witten theory for affine space on the level of a circle, you could say, the naive statement you want, Kapustin, Rozanski, Salina, say, for example, there's an ansatz, which is it's quasi-coherent sheaves of categories on the base. But that's not quite right, because you need to come to some int co-version of that. So even to define the category attached, even in the case of a vector space, what is Rozanski-Witten theory attach to a simple, to A2M on the level of the circle? The answer is not modules for QC of a polarization. It's some int co, so it needs Stefanich's, two int co theory. And then it's not clear, I think it's a wrong statement what I'm about to say, but you could imagine, is this invariant under Fourier transform? You change polarization, you get a Fourier transform on this two int co, and you have to be, and that's even not clear. So I guess I'm saying that even without the group G check, even if you should just take A to N, there's some subtleties even on the B side, which is somehow the easier side. So these are great questions. And it's just to say that there's, when you're polarized, it's easy to quantize polarized things. And when you're not polarized, there's a science that has to be done even in classical geometric quantization. And this is kind of the two-shifted analog of that science that hasn't yet been developed. Yeah, but even if when you know what the category is, for example, the category attached to a circle should be not just a category, but a factorization category, an E2 category. Can you describe that E2 structure in a way that's independent of polarization?
Sure, but I mean, I'll be happy first for the category itself. Just
I think that's great. I mean, these are great questions, and I think they're subtle. For example, you said local geometric lines. No one has written down, as far as I know, a statement of what local geometric lines actually is, right? Because it's not
you mean this quasi-co versus inco story? Yeah. Well,
yeah, but I think that's very relevant.
I mean, for the purposes of this question, I think it's probably not.
I think that's exactly the issue, right? Because if you look at quasi-co instead of inco, that can't be independent of polarization. That's a completion along the zero.
Sure, section. There is a precise formulation to Tarinkin, but just. It's probably not written down anywhere, but there's a kind of analog of this nilpotent singular support story in that case.
Well, the problem is not the singular support. The problem is what is intco. Forget about the singular support.
No, it probably appeared in the Benjamin Stock also this condition. So it's just you can see the not modules over quasi-co, but some kind of modified version of that.
So that's Stefanich's thesis that develops this two int co, but I'm saying it's a subtle object, even, even in simple situations. So there is a
if you restrict to int co with some Lagrangian singular support condition, which that Lagrangian is manifestly Fourier invariant, I claim that you're going to see the Fourier invariance of two int co. You can certainly, at least in the vector space case, it's very clear that you can see that right away. The symplectic vector space case you mentioned. I mean, presumably this nilpotent thing also, you can try and imagine how to do that.
Right. Okay, in any case, my point is that these are subtle questions.
Okay.
I think that's clear. And certainly we have nothing new to say about them.
All right, well, let's thank David again.